You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, in for Rob Ferret. Coming up later in the program, we'll learn more about the effectiveness of limiting full contact football practices to keep athletes safer. Now, ask anyone in Wisconsin, or anywhere really, about their opinion on roads, and you're bound to get at least a few colorful responses, to say the least. Anytime we cover the issue on Central Time, we frequently hear from our listeners that this is a big issue that impacts their families, their jobs, and their communities. According to a report, the cost to build 1 mile of highway in the 1960s tripled in a 20-year period. And that'll likely mean that the cost to build and repair these roads will continue to climb as more of these roadways fall into disrepair. So, how did we get to where we are now, and how do we fix it? Our next guest took a look at the issue in a recent essay and joins us now. Noah Smith is an economist and opinion writer for Bloomberg. Noah, thanks for joining us.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. Thanks for joining us to talk about this topic. It is always something of concern for our listeners, and I'm guessing for people across the country. Can you break down for us the difference between capital projects in a budget and other infrastructure spending?
Capital projects in a budget and other infrastructure spending?
What
is the question you're asking me?
How does infrastructure get paid for?
Oh, I mean, you know, infrastructure gets paid for a number of ways. You have, you know, like the highway trust fund and other things like that. You can also pay for it out of general revenue. States and localities build a lot of infrastructure. The federal government kicks some money in. So there's a variety we have of paying for these things. Is that what you're asking?
Yeah. So what's the difference, maybe I should say, between, say, building a new road or trying to maintain a road that was built maybe, you know, 50 years ago?
So one thing is that when you build a road and it lasts for 50 years, networks of economic activity spring up around it. So you have businesses near the road. You have cities that are sort of alongside the road and you know, near the road, and it supports a lot of economic activity. So when you build a new road, you're hoping that economic activity will mushroom around that road. So, but, you know, it's a bit of a risk, doesn't always pay off. When you maintain an old road, you know that there's already a network of existing economic activity around it. So the risk of spending is much less. Also, regular maintenance allows you to, the more regular maintenance is, the lower the cost of maintenance, because when you let a road go for too long without being repaired, it just gets really potholed beyond repair, and the costs go up non-linearly, you know.
I kind of think of it as when I ignore my garden for weeks and weeks and the amount of weeds that grow versus going out there and pulling a few every day, I can kind of keep up. But it seems like in the U.S., we have really neglected our infrastructure for quite a while.
Yeah, yes, we have. Our infrastructure isn't terrible, but it's definitely not the best. We built this huge, we built this huge network of interstates, really good road networks, and it's been a struggle to upkeep those. Now, part of that might have been because we built too much. You know, we sprawled too much. We built too many suburbs. We have this giant country. But when you look at cost comparisons between us and other countries about how much it takes to build a mile of road, then you see that it costs like twice as much to build a mile of road, or maybe, you know, three times as much here as in other countries like France or, you know, other rich countries. And so the question is, why is that?
Yeah, let's go into that more, because we did say earlier that the cost to build 1 mile of highway, what the cost was in the 60s, it tripled in a 20-year period. What are some of the ways that the costs have gone up in the U.S. and haven't, as you said, in other countries?
Well, so in terms of what are the ways the costs have gone up, it's very difficult because, you know, we use contractors for these things, right? And so the government hires contractors, and the contractors bill you a cost. So unless you have a whole bunch of, you know, forensic experts go into these contractors' books and actually look at what is driving these costs over time and get the books from, you know, like 30, 50 years ago, whatever, it's very difficult to tell what has increased, and it's even more difficult to tell why it has increased. So, you know, researchers are trying to piece it together from available data. two things that we can probably rule out at this point are, number one, high wages for construction workers. So it turns out that our wages are actually not higher than those of other rich countries. And that wages for construction workers have gone up only a little bit, even while costs have absolutely exploded. And another thing it probably isn't is land acquisition costs. So we say, oh, well, you know, the United States is a democratic country where it's difficult to get the land to build the road on. Well, actually, it turns out that that's harder for other countries, and they're still building these roads much more cheaply. So we have to look for other factors besides those two obvious ones. A lot of people will blame expensive construction on the Davis-Bacon law, which is this old law that says that you have to basically pay prevailing wage rates, and you set wages for construction basically by union rates, but it turns out that that's not driving our high costs.
Well, and a lot of those other countries that you're talking about have actually much higher rates of unionization as well.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And even if they don't have higher rates of unionization, they also have these laws that say that all workers who are not unionized are actually covered by collective bargaining, so they might as well be unionized in terms of their wages. And so, yeah, I mean, you look at France and tell me that, you know, if unions were what caused problems, France would have much bigger problems than us in this regard.
We're talking to Noah Smith. He's an economist and opinion writer for Bloomberg, and we're talking about ways to pay for infrastructure in the United States and why our infrastructure is in such bad condition. And let's talk a little bit about the impact of poor roads and highways. What does it do to the economy, Noah?
So it makes everything harder. You know, it's difficult for workers to get to their jobs. You know, when I lived in New York, I had to drive across the Verrazano Bridge, and this bridge would get massive potholes every year, and then they'd just barely patch up the potholes enough to allow people to drive over it, and that would take months. And then it would just, you know, but since it wouldn't be a permanent fix, you know, the potholes would just come back, and so it's hard for workers to get to where they're going. It's also hard to transport products. You know, you've got to transport inputs into factories, and you've got to transport products to where people live, and all these kind of things, and it just gums up all of that. So it just hurts economic activity in a variety of ways to have bad infrastructure. And the thing is, what we've been doing is throwing money at the problem. You know, everybody will get really mad and say, oh, our infrastructure is so terrible, we've got to spend more, which in the short run is true because we can't easily bring down costs in the short run. So what we do is we lob more money at it, which is what we need to do in the short run. And then, you know, and then the infrastructure gets patched up, and then the, you know, the civil engineers raise our grade from like, you know, a D minus to like a C minus or something. And then everyone says, okay, problem averted. We threw money at it. And then they wait until the, you know, the problems crop up again. But each time it costs more, and the amount of money that we have to throw at it each time gets higher. And at some point people are going to say, well, let's not throw money at it. Let's just let some of these roads decay and some of these towns, you know, die and companies die. And that will be a big problem.
Why do you think there seems to be such a lack of political will to make the investments now that are important? As we said at the beginning of the interview, pretty much everyone thinks that our roads need to be improved, that they're in bad shape. There was a recent poll that said that the vast majority of Americans want new highway maintenance and other construction projects to be flood-proof, because we've seen so much happening with flooding. Why does it seem like it's so hard for politicians and policymakers to get behind this?
Well, I think that cost. So one of the problems is that it becomes a political football, and America is a highly polarized country, even increasingly at the state level. But another problem is that it just costs so much. You know, imagine if it cost $10 billion to build each mile of road. Well, definitely almost zero roads would get built ever, because that's just too expensive for roads. And people would want roads, it's just that we couldn't afford to build them. So we're not there yet, obviously, but the higher the cost goes up, the more bitter fights are going to be over whether or not to shell out the increasingly large amounts of money to maintain this infrastructure. So if we want, it's not that we as a society don't want infrastructure, it's that there's always a cost-benefit analysis. And as these costs keep spiraling up and the benefits, you know, stay the same, it gets harder and harder to make that hurdle, if that makes any sense.
Sure. And briefly, Noah, do you think this issue is going to get worse before it gets better?
Well, probably, because for it to get better, it's going to take a sustained effort at both the federal and, you know, state and local levels to identify the costs of rising infrastructure costs and beat them down. You know, in the meantime, costs are going to keep going up. So yeah, it's going to get worse before it gets better, but hopefully not too much worse if we, and people are starting to pay more attention to this issue. So maybe not too much worse, I hope.
Well, Noah, thanks so much for joining us.
All right. Thank you for having me on.
Noah Smith is an economist and opinion writer for Bloomberg. He joined us today to talk about the state of infrastructure spending in the United States and what we might learn from other countries when it comes to maintaining our roads. You can read Noah's piece at WPR.org/Central Time. Coming up, we will talk about how different our lives might be without refrigeration. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Coming up, we'll look at the relationship between full contact practices and concussions in high school football. First, even in the dog days of summer, we may not pay much attention to how different life would be without refrigeration. But it turns out that when humans developed ways to cool things thousands of years ago, it set the stage for many of our most important discoveries and advances. Helen Pevitt is curator of consumer technology at the Science Museum in London, and she's the author of the book Refrigerator, The Story of Cool in the Kitchen. Helen, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, nice to meet you, Judith.
So do we know when people first started trying to keep things cool?
Kind of hard to say, but I'm guessing if you've had ice around, people were probably using it. So it's probably if you were in a cold area, so maybe Canada, Alaska, northern Russia, if you had ice around, then people are going to have been using it maybe to preserve what they've grown or caught locally. So it's, even though it's not recorded, people tend to think they've been using it for thousands of years.
And what were some of the earliest techniques? You mentioned ice, but you know that's not available to a lot of people in the world. What were some of the earliest techniques that were used that might have been used in warmer climates?
Yeah, people were quite cunning. So you could even produce ice in the desert, which sounds counterintuitive. The Persians, ancient Persians, built great big massive walls even in the middle of the desert. And what they would do is put vessels behind the walls in the shadow, and at night time they'd put something inside that. They'd fill outside the vessel with water, and the evaporation would evaporate the water and leave ice behind. So even in the middle of the desert, you could produce a little bit of ice.
And when would what we might think of as modern refrigeration first become available?
Yeah, that's a really interesting one. We've sort of got a taste ice and for cooling things, and that really came from you in America, I think. Frederick Tudor, Ice King, started a trade in ice and cold ice in the early 19th century, and he was really the first one to see that there was a real value to selling ice, not just to cool your food and drink, but actually to use in food and drink to eat. So from then, really, it's really taken off. At some point in the mid-19th century, there's so much demand for ice, they actually couldn't meet that demand anymore. You couldn't just harvest it naturally from American lakes, or in Britain you might harvest little scrappy bits from ponds over here. We didn't generate as much here. You had to look elsewhere. So they started looking to new steam-powered machinery, really, to produce ice in massive quantities. So from, I guess, mid-19th century, early Victorian period, that's when they start making these whacking great machines, refrigeration machines, ice-making machines that produce ice on a massive scale.
It seems like refrigeration has had the potential to make us healthier for all of the different foods that we're able to access, keeping it cool, presumably safe. Does what seems to be kind of common sense, does that actually bear out?
Yeah, I don't know. I have mixed feelings about this. I think it probably does. It's sort of like a food hub, isn't it? You can almost hold the whole world in your fridge, if you want, in your kitchen. So it's given us unprecedented access to all sorts of different types of foods, fresh fruit, anytime you want it. So that's got to be a good thing in some ways. But, of course, hidden behind that is all the food miles, all this stuff is traveling. But in many ways, I suppose food's probably safer than it ever has been. It's kept cool pretty reliably all the way through that cold chain until it gets to us. So in some ways, I think that's probably true. Our food is probably safer than it ever has been. I suppose the downside of that is you kind of lose, I kind of feel that you've lost, or many of us have lost the sense of what the tacit knowledge we used to have about what is fresh. I don't always know if stuff I'm keeping in there is okay to still use or if I should be chucking it away. I also think I'll probably rely on convenience foods more than I would do. Maybe I cook less and maybe I produce more food waste. So I guess there's two things going on there. In some ways it's making it more healthy and more reliable for us, but, you know, there's a downside. Like everything, like every technology, there's a bit of a downside as well.
We're talking with Helen Pevitt. She's curator of consumer technology at the Science Museum in London, and we're talking about refrigeration and the impact it's had on human development. And Helen, speaking of health, refrigeration is also a really important part of modern medicine. Can you give us some examples of that?
Yeah, I haven't, until I started researching for the book, I haven't even thought about it, but most of the vaccines, and I suppose even more crucially, blood supplies that get that have to travel around the world, not just not around our countries, but also to some more remote places where maybe there's less of a power supply, they have to be kept at the right temperature. And once that temperature's exceeded, you can't use them anymore. So keeping them at a low temperature is crucial. So I hadn't realized, I hadn't appreciated that things like any of the common vaccines we use today, HIV virus vaccine or any of the blood supplies, do have to be kept so cold.
And so that is interesting because you think of, say, those vaccines being taken to remote places in different countries where they are desperately needed, but where there might not be even reliable electricity. So what kind of refrigeration is possible in those pretty extreme conditions?
Really interesting. There have been some quite nifty gadgets that actually are sort of going back to old types of technology. So all the ice boxes we used to have in our home really started off in America, big insulated ice boxes that just kept things cool, not by extracting heat like our refrigerators do, but just by insulating against the outside temperature, a bit like a lunchbox, I suppose. All of those technologies start coming back into play. So in really remote places, they've started making quite sophisticated ice boxes that actually keep vaccines cold for maybe 3-4 days so you can get them to where they need to be. And you can also get solar-powered ones as well. So we're kind of almost looking back to an older type of technology in the 21st century to keep vaccines cold enough to get them around the world.
And I hadn't thought much about it until reading your book, but all kinds of science depends on the ability to cool things. You mentioned space exploration and what also you call the world's largest and most famous science experiment, the Large Hadron Collider that found the Higgs particle. How does refrigeration make those two things possible?
Yeah, that's I suppose it is, isn't it? The biggest science experiment in the world, and this has been a big one made since. But the way that works is it has to keep the protons running around the great giant underground ring. I think it's about 27 kilometres long, this little ring that's running underneath CERN in Switzerland, to keep those protons on track and to keep on that search for particles they found like the Higgs, and also they're still searching for dark matter. You need to keep the circuit really, really cool. It's working by using powerful superconducting magnets, and they have to be super cool to just above absolute zero to work properly, which is colder than outer space. So, yeah, even within things like that, refrigeration is crucial to the success of those experiments.
And then also for people doing spacewalks, refrigeration is important.
Yeah, the thing about outer space is that obviously you can't convect your heat away. So any astronauts going out on a spacewalk, they are at the mercy of whether or not they're in the sunshine or in the shade. So you can alternate between freezing and overheating and boiling. So it's absolutely vital that what those astronauts do is underneath their main suit, they wear a sort of cooled liquid undergarment, which helps regulate their temperature. It's regulating between the hot and cold.
Wow, that's just fascinating. And like I said, nothing that I thought about before reading your book. Well, we've talked a lot about the many positives to refrigeration. Are there negatives in refrigeration being such a prominent part of modern human day life?
I think it's got to be. Imagine if the power went down. We've seen when we've had power cuts before. You think about Hurricane Katrina, those unforgettable images of all the abandoned fridges left in the aftermath, just unusable because the power's gone down. And they've lost that access to that cold, reliable food supply. The minute the power goes down, I think we're in trouble. We've become so reliant on it and on the refrigerated cold chain all the way along. I think we'd be absolutely lost without it. It would be complete chaos if we suddenly found tomorrow we couldn't use it anymore. So we're super over-reliant on it, and I can't see that doing anything but increase.
Well, and also I'm wondering about environmental impact. That many appliances running worldwide, but also I'm sure that the technology is advanced, but I'm sure there's still a footprint to having just a simple home refrigerator.
Yeah, big footprints. There have been some real, you know, real positives. So we've seen them become more environmentally efficient and more eco-efficient, and they use far less energy than they used to, and they've got safer refrigerants. But the downside is that we tend to be using bigger machines, and, of course, as other parts of the world get access to refrigeration and all the advantages it brings, safe food, freedom from having to go and shop every day, and all the advantages come with that downside. But actually, yeah, more and more of us are relying on using them. So, yeah, mixed blessing again.
Well, and as we wrap up, Helen, are there any exciting developments in refrigeration that you're seeing coming over the horizon?
Oh, wow. Do you know, for the last 10 years, I've been told that the next exciting development will be smart fridges, but I don't think that's where the real development's going to be. I think we're going to see real changes in how they actually are powered. So I think we're going to see a generation of things like magnetic refrigerators, which move away from the whole engine compressor powered refrigeration system and use smart, slightly savvier ways of cooling things inside.
Well, Helen, thank you so much. This was very interesting.
Judith, nice to talk to you today.
Helen Pevitt is curator of consumer technology at the Science Museum in London. She joined us to talk about her book, Refrigerator, The Story of Cool in the Kitchen. Coming up next, we'll look at the relationship between full contact practices and concussions in high school football, and we'll ask you to share your thoughts on whether there should be limits on how much contact happens in football. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, in for Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, in for Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow after 6 on the morning show, the 60th Lumberjack World Championships are this weekend in Hayward. Kate Archer-Kent and her guests look into the history of the event, which features chopping, sawing, axe throwing, log rolling, and more. That's tomorrow morning at 6 here on the Ideas Network. Now, high school football season is right around the corner, which means that practices across Wisconsin are getting underway. With player safety at the forefront, the Wisconsin Interscholastic Athletic Association, or WIAA, made a big change in 2014, one that limited the amount of full contact practice a team could engage in. Now, a new study finds that the rule change appears to be paying off. Researchers from UW-Madison found that the rate of sports-related concussions during high school football practice in Wisconsin has decreased by 57% since the change went into effect. Tim McGuine joins us now to talk more about the study, the results, and what it means for high school football. He's a distinguished scientist in the Department of Orthopedics and Rehabilitation at UW-Madison's School of Medicine and Public Health. Tim, thanks for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me.
Well, take us back to 2014 and this rule change. What exactly did the WIAA lay out?
Well, the WIAA was looking around the country and looking at other states, like Michigan had started some initial work in this area, thinking maybe we could set some specific guidelines on how much contact they could have. Now, that there has also been an acclimatization period where they didn't allow any contact with full equipment the first several days to people get acclimated to the heat, et cetera. But this laid out a more rigorous guideline that said you can only do so many minutes a day of full contact, and limit also events like partial contact events, not just during the practice during the preseason, but during then the entire football season throughout the year.
I understand this was a fairly unique rule change. Were there any other states or athletic conferences at the time that were considering or making similar changes?
Well, Michigan had toyed with the idea and had actually started to implement something, but they hadn't really studied the effect of that. Now, I think there's anecdotally, you know, some people have been saying this for a long time. I know as an athletic trainer, being on the sidelines for 30 years, we always said that if you limit contact, you're going to have fewer concussions, you're going to have fewer ankle sprains, you're going to have fewer clavicle fractures, you're going to have fewer quad contusions and everything. So from a medical standpoint, that'd been advocated and anecdotally, you know, advocated for a way to go ahead and reduce concussions and all the other injuries.
Prior to 2014, how prevalent were head injuries and concussions in high school football?
Well, we can look at the overall rate per 1,000 exposures. So it was about 5.8 injuries per 1,000 exposures, which is, people should be aware, football still has the highest rate of concussion per exposure, per practice or game, followed by like boys lacrosse, girls soccer, et cetera. That's about what it was. And the overall rate in terms of game rate didn't really change, which is actually a good sign because there's some people thinking that if we reduce the rate in practice or we limit the way kids are practicing, that's going to put them more at risk during games. And we didn't see that. We didn't see it drop or change in games. So that was good. It wasn't increasing there as well.
And that logic that you were just saying about people who were concerned about the change was that with out the practice of that kind of contact sport, that there were chances that people would not learn the right way to do it.
Yes, and that's one of the things. When people make rule changes, we always caution, and I know I work at not just the state level, but the national level, and say that to make a rule change without understanding the full consequences of it is really a mistake. My example is you can't take water out of one part of a bucket. If you have a bucket full of water, you can't just take water out of one side. If you take water out, it affects the whole level of water in that bucket, or to take air out of a balloon. If you take air out of a balloon, it affects the whole shape of the balloon. And so one of the things we are concerned with any rule change is, okay, if you put this in, it may sound good from a PR standpoint, a soundbite, but we really need to study that and say, well, what does it do to that injury rate? What does it do to other injury rates? Or how does it affect the football game or any game, competition, practices, and any sport?
Tim, are high school athletes especially susceptible to concussions because of their age or their physical development?
Well, there's some evidence that kids at a younger age, there's evidence that the brain may be more susceptible to injury and suffer the effects of a concussion. There's also a growing body of evidence that overall strength, the torso and the neck in particular, are related to risks of concussion. So you have a small, slender person with not a large neck musculature. There's some evidence of saying that might be a reason that they're getting concussed, that when they take a blow to their body or the head, the neck muscles aren't strong enough to help absorb and mitigate that blow. That's a large reason why some people feel females are more and more likely to have a concussion. We know that females, say soccer players, are 3 to 3.5 times greater risk of having a concussion than their male counterparts. And some scientists believe it's the lack of neck strength that's putting them at risk. So you could say the same thing, too, about any immature athlete that would have neck musculature that isn't strong.
We're talking with Tim McGuine right now. He's a distinguished scientist in the Department of Orthopedics and Rehabilitation at UW-Madison's School of Medicine and Public Health. And we're talking about research into the effects of a rule change by the WIAA that happened about 5 years ago. It limited the contact aspects of high school football practices. And Tim, something that just occurred to me is, do we know kind of time-wise, hours on the field, how the time students are spending practicing compares to the hours that they're spending playing?
It's usually, practice hours, usually it's about 5 to 1. So for every hour of practice, it's usually 1 hour of game competition. Now, that may fluctuate. Some schools practice more, some practice less. And so we roughly think that estimate is about applicable to most schools in the state of Wisconsin. And I also should say, too, that then when it comes to football in particular, and I think the best coaches in the state of Wisconsin have already limited this. I know a number of schools said that if you put this rule in, this won't affect us because we already don't hit a great deal. We've limited contact. We've done those things. Now, if I go to some of the best programs in the state, they've had that unwritten rule in their own practices for years where they just said, we're not going to do that. We're not going to put these kids in contact because we know we're practicing so much more than we're playing. Let's get that risk out of practice.
So let's talk specifically about the study now. What exactly were you looking at and what data were you comparing to come to your conclusions?
Well, we had collected data in 2012 and 13 looking at football helmets designs and what they were doing with relation to concussion. We had published that data, and then as we finished up that study, the WA had put this rule change in effect, and we already had this wonderful rich data from a number of schools with 2,000 kids in the years before, and we were able then to move right into the second aspect of the study, and we enrolled another 940, almost 1,000 kids in 2014, and went out and looked at the same thing. We had athletic trainers on the ground every day recording who practiced, who played, if they played in a practice or game, if they had a concussion, what type of event caused it, and then what symptoms they experienced, how long they were out, how long they experienced symptoms, did they see a doctor, did they have any other imaging, were they disqualified? We had all that data coming in to do this, and by doing that, you can look at what we call player exposure. So we had thousands and thousands of player exposures, practices, and games, and by doing that, you can get a very rich data set and actually compare these numbers.
We're talking right now with Tim McGuine. He's a distinguished scientist in the Department of Orthopedics and Rehabilitation at UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. We're talking about the relationship between full contact football practice and concussions. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Are you the parent of a high school football player? Do you agree with limits on contact in practice? Do you think it keeps your player safer? What else do you think can be done to minimize the concussion risk? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation in just a bit here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. We're continuing our conversation with researcher Tim McGuine about the relationship between full contact football practice and concussions. According to his new study, the concussion rate in high school football was cut by more than half after a 2014 WIAA rule change limiting full contact practice. Listeners, what do you think? We're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. Are you the parent of a high school athlete, or perhaps you're an athlete yourself? Has limiting contact in practice been a good thing? What else can make practice and games safer? And what questions do you have about concussions? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or tweet us at Central Time WPR. And Tim, one question that I wanted to ask you is, are there rules in place? Is it mandatory to report potential concussions among high school athletes?
In terms of reporting, like, there's no centralized system where they're required to go ahead and report that. However, the WIA has a rule in place that anybody suspected of having a concussion or you know, showing concussion type symptoms should be immediately removed and evaluated. And that can take a coach, an assistant coach, an official. Anybody can say, hey, I think that kid might be sustained a concussion, get him out of the game. And then if there's an athletic trainer, medical person on the sideline, we immediately take over, evaluate the kid, and take a look to make sure, are there symptoms here significantly correlated with a concussion? If they are, they're going to be out. If somebody's been told they have a concussion, then they're not allowed to return to any high school sport in the state of Wisconsin until they're evaluated by a medical provider and cleared. So once somebody says they do have a concussion, they don't have to go. But in terms of a central reporting system, there's not a central database or anything goes into.
You just talked about the role that athletic trainers can play in reducing and identifying concussion risk. What about parents? Do they have a role in this?
Well, they do. I think to be aware and to be aware of signs and symptoms of a concussion is very important. I think they see the athletes far more than the athletic trainer do. And I know people say the last person that my teenage son wants to talk to is their mom, you know, on a day-to-day basis. So we get that. But in terms of, they will know more and see the interaction at home and if there's something going on to make us aware. And I think that, you know, that's one thing I think parents can do. The other thing I think is to do is put this in context that while we need to be concerned about concussions and all sport injuries, I think we got to take the fear aspect out of it, because fear now is driving a lot of decisions, and that's always a poor thing. If I don't want my son to play hockey or my daughter to play soccer because of the rate of risk of concussion, you need to step back and say the benefits for these activities far outweigh the risks. And we've just done some other research where we looked at kids that have had concussion and the state of Wisconsin, and we're just not seeing the long-term impact on these injuries that have been reported in these scare headlines about these kids are going to be depressed and have all these issues going on. In our studies of Wisconsin athletes, we're not finding that. We're not finding that at all.
What can coaches do to both, you know, address those concerns, that fear on the part of parents, perhaps, but also to be good advocates for keeping the kids safe?
I think communication is one of the best things. I know the WA requires parents to acknowledge they watched the video of what they're doing, the signs and symptoms of concussion, how to prevent these and how to recognize these injuries. I think a lot of good high school programs have parent meetings, and they go over what they expect the kids and how they try to teach safe techniques and how to be reinforced. And that should be reinforced at home. It doesn't do good if the coach is saying we want to safely tackle, and then mom or dad says you've got to throw your body around, lead with your head, and play more aggressively. That's not a good thing. So I think the coaches can do that. And I said one thing the parents can do is we're also showing if you have an athletic trainer at your school, you're much more likely to recognize concussion and actually they're more likely to stay out longer. An athlete being under the care of an athletic trainer is staying out longer from their sport, going back in a safe situation, than schools where they have limited access to athletic trainers.
We're talking with Tim McGuine from the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. We're talking about concussions in high school sports. And Tim, I want to make sure that we give people the information they need to be able to identify a possible concussion. What should we be watching for?
Well, the signs and symptoms includes is a whole battery of common symptoms, and it can be something as simple as forgetfulness, headache, dizziness, confusion, problem with vision, problem hearing, ringing in the ears, any of those type of things, sleep disturbances. One of the ones people say if they're more moody or more upset or more emotional, those are symptoms that if those are taking place, especially after a hard blow to the head, then we'd want to evaluate that athlete to make sure they don't have something else going on, or if they do have a concussion type activity. Those are the type of things that any parent should be able to recognize in that situation. And again, it's amazing how many times I may see something on a sideline. I may think everything's going okay, and a coach will come up to me and say, can you check on number so-and-so? He's gone the wrong way the last two plays. We don't think he's having trouble out there, and you bring him off the sideline, and sure enough, they're showing signs of a concussion that nobody picked up on, but the coach realized it because they weren't doing the proper assignments on the field.
And what should the student athletes themselves be thinking about as they're going into practice, into games, with the idea that while there are many good reasons for playing sports, concussions are a serious concern?
They are, and I think my issue with the athletes and the parents and everybody said, be honest. You have to be honest. If you sustain a blow and are concerned, let us know. Let us take a look at you. Let us evaluate this to make sure we're aware of the injury. Then maybe it might be a concussion. It might not. But let's go ahead and do that. And as I said, one of the most frustrating things on the sidelines when I see it is if I don't know the athletes very well, I don't know their personality, that can be hard. And I always look at an athlete and their parents. I say, I can only do so much. I'm going to ask your son or daughter questions. But they've got to be honest with me and tell me specifically what symptoms they're having. If they're not honest with me, I can't make that determination. We can't wave a magic wand over the athlete's head and say, yes, this person's concussed, that person isn't. A lot of it is the feedback from the athlete themselves.
And is part of it kind of explaining to them, if you take care of yourself, if you let us know what's going on, there's a good chance that you will be able to come back and play and you won't have those lasting effects?
That's it, exactly. There's some good research that says, the biggest issue was with number of repeat concussions is if they return too early. And I like to tell athletes, and we used to tell people, usually you're out for a week. Well, now in the state of Wisconsin, the athletic trainers are keeping these kids out usually 2 weeks. And the good news about that is when they do that, the risk of having a repeat concussion that year is very, very low. That if we can get that time away from the sport, whether it's basketball, soccer, ice hockey, or football, we know that we can reduce the risk of repeat concussions dramatically. And so getting that then, I'd like to tell people, I understand it's only been 4 or 5 days. You think you're doing great. You want to play Friday night. If we can skip you into that next week and take another 4 or 5 days, the likelihood of you ever having a problem again is minimal.
Well, Tim, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Tim McGuine is a distinguished scientist in the Department of Orthopedics and Rehabilitation at UW-Madison's School of Medicine and Public Health. He joined us to talk about the relationship between full contact football practice and concussions. Great Lakes have had a record-breaking summer. Lakes Erie and Ontario are seeing the highest water levels ever recorded. Lake Superior remains high for this time of year. WPR's Danielle Kading recently caught up with lakefront property owners there who are dealing with the encroaching water.
Theron O'Connor stands on the shoreline of his lakefront property, just a few miles outside Cornucopia. He and his family have been coming to his grandfather's cabin since they were kids.
It was built by a Swedish immigrant, Charlie Saxine, and he built the cabin, hand-hewn, two-story log, rectangular building. And then my grandfather kind of added on to it.
O'Connor, who lives in Bayfield, says it's a place they all come back to for a couple weeks a year. But the cabin just beyond the bank may not be where it is now if high water levels and storms continue to pound the shoreline. There's little or no beach, and trees lean toward the water. O'Connor says they cut some down to keep them from tearing away the hillside.
The land is so saturated that it won't really hold. This is basically clay with a little bit of sandy loam on top of it. And that got absolutely saturated, both from the heavy rains and snows of the last 2 years.
If erosion continues to creep closer, O'Connor says they may have to move his grandfather's cabin back several hundred feet from the shore. Even if lake levels go down, his wife Damaris Brinton says that won't stop the rain.
That water comes down like somebody has turned over Lake Superior on top of us. You know, it's a remarkable amount of water coming down at once.
So you want to wander...
Sure, yeah.
We should go down toward Ken's house.
Ken Prey and his family own property next to O'Connor, just through the woods. He points to huge rifts in the soil slumping downward and a tree where a hammock had been tied. Now it stands in two pieces, several feet apart, split down the middle from erosion.
The other end of the hammock is on the hook on that tree. But that thing used to be right here.
Prey thinks the erosion would be much worse if not for all the trees lining the hillside.
I think typically a lot of people would say, well, I want a nice view of that point, so let's move, get those trees out of there. And that's then where you get in trouble, because it's only the roots. That's all you got.
Bayfield County Zoning Director Rob Shearman says proper land management is a constant battle with lakefront property owners.
If you're going to be cutting down all the vegetation that you can see the lake, like you're looking at a picture, you can expect to have problems with erosion in your structure might not last as long as you want it to.
Shearman says several cabins or homes are moved back from the shoreline in Bayfield County each year. High water levels and storms have only made the problem worse, resulting in millions of dollars in damage across the Great Lakes. Some are blaming the International Joint Commission, which oversees water flows. But Chief Hydrologist Keith Kompoltowicz with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers says the ability to control outflows doesn't mean you can control lake levels.
It's a matter of scale, to be quite honest with you. Lake Superior is extremely large, and the variability in the rainfall, runoff, and evaporation that falls on Lake Superior is much greater than the ability to increase or decrease outflow.
Record high levels on the Great Lakes come on the heels of record low water levels, according to Drew Gronewald. He's associate professor with the University of Michigan School for Environment and Sustainability. Gronewald says they're exploring whether increased rain and snowfall, along with high water temperatures and evaporation, are normal or the result of climate change.
So what we're trying to understand better is, to what extent is this amplification of those extremes leading to swings in water levels from one extreme to the other?
Gronewald says it's hard to predict what lake levels will look like over the long term. Lakefront property owners like O'Connor hope they'll fall sooner rather than later.
It could be that this will kind of heal up again and go back and be stable terrain again.
Until then, he says they're pulling together construction details in case they have to move back from the shoreline. Danielle Kading, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, a new research project is bringing together tribal and UW researchers on the issue of wild rice protection and restoration. We'll learn about the aims of the project as well as the state of wild rice in Wisconsin. That's tomorrow on Central Time.